Oh.
Hey. Yeah, I'm here. Couldn't hear the music. And if I can't hear the music, I can't do the show. So I had to turn up my headphones. Hey, back live in the studio here at the 860 AM WDB complex high above Balakinwood. Hope you enjoyed last week's greatest hits compilation. I know I kind of said something about a comedy show, but, technical difficulties got in the way. And hey, that's showbiz, babe. And that's what you're listening to. And, we have a little bit of bad news today, but, much more good news. The little bit of bad news is that unfortunately our movie lady, Leanne Lindsay, cannot be with us today. But the good news is that that gives our other three regular contributors, A.D. Amorosi, Neil Zuhr, and Ken Allen, a lot more time than they might have otherwise received today. So that's good news. And even better news, coming up in about 20 minutes or so, we are going to play my chat with a guy who is as big a classic rock personality or personage as you can find, although he's never been a star. I mean, he can walk into the, you know, supermarket and not get besieged. He's not Mick Jagger, you know, or Peter Townsend or somebody like that. But his name is Ian McDonald, and he was a co-founder of both King Crimson, the pioneering prog rock band of the late 1960s, and still going strong. They just announced a U.S. tour a little later on this year. And then when he left Crimson and went on a few years later to co-found Foreigner, which I think you'll agree is one of the bigger bands of the 1970s. So pretty interesting stuff. He's got a new band called Honey West, which is the main reason why we invited him on the show. And I hope you enjoy that, if you're a longtime fan of his and Crimson and Foreigner, or if you've never heard of the guy. Now, you know, you've certainly heard him play his music. So anyway, that's the really good news. And what else? I'm just happy to be back. I was in Portland, Oregon last week visiting my daughter, and it was so wonderful. It's such a cool city. I recommend it to everybody, especially those who like to eat. I had three of the best restaurant meals or dinners that I've ever had consecutively, and I go to restaurants pretty much every night of the week. So, except, of course, when I go to the Kibitz Room, which we know is the greatest deli in the world, but that's usually for lunch. Anyway, let's get started. I don't think I have anything else to say of that great importance that we can't, get the show on the road. So with no further ado, we bring in our first regular contributor of the show this week. And, of course, leading off, as always, our scrappy clean leadoff hitter. And that's Scrappy with an S, by the way, just to make sure, to clarify. Neil Zuhrin, how the heck are you, Neil?
I'm going to get to a mini Minoso and take one for the team. You have me wondering whether Anne Francis is still alive. I don't think she is. She played Honey West on television.
Yes, and the band, as you'll learn if you listen, was named in homage to the TV show.
There you go. And what I loved about her, she had a pet ocelot, which is the first time I heard of ocelot, which is a great Scrabble word.
Right.
Especially being the C on double letter, triple letters. So it's good. Ocelot.
And she was, at least to these 10-year-old eyes, she was pretty hot, Anne Francis.
I think that was the whole key to the show.
I think so. In a really ultra schicksal way, I might add.
That's right.
She didn't look like any woman who lived in the Northeast that I knew of.
with a little birthmark,
yeah,
her,
very high. Right. And she was also
her nostril and her dimple.
And I guess when you people think of her and who know who she is, immediately they think of Honey West, which was groundbreaking because she played the first female. Her character was the first female secret agent or a detective. I thought she was a secret agent.
Yes, Secret Agent.
You're right. But she was actually, she played Glenn Ford's wife in, I can't think of the name, Blackboard Jungle.
Yes.
Yeah.
She's in a lot of movies. She's a good actress. I mean, if the noir era had just extended another decade, she would have been the Veronica Lake of her time.
I like that. But she also had a co-starring role in Funny Girl, didn't she?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
She played one of the Ziegfeld girls.
She had a lot of, she did a lot, but of course she's known most of her Honey West,
right?
Obviously, and she's known very well if somebody's named a band after her.
Right, so, there you go. Anyway,
great.
Okay, now that we've done a little pop culture history mining, what's new with you? What are you watching? What are you going to see? What did you see on stage?
Well, there's a lot going on in the theater, a lot going on television. I guess the big thing on television, I haven't seen it yet. I would remiss, but I want to see what's happening with the recurrence of Twin Peaks coming back. I want to see if Laura Parker is still dead, even though we know from 20 years ago who did it. So I want to see what's happening with that. But mostly it's the stage. And the stage has been fascinating lately to me because there's one wonderful production, Witness for the Prosecution, that's being done at Bristol Riverside Theater, that takes an old classic and does it without trying to ham it up or hoke it up, just does it straight. Fabulous production with Keith Baker and Carl Wallnau. Matt Leisey and Elmer Handley just doing a marvelous job acting. And they are acting in a production that's sort of worth it. I've seen so much great acting lately, but in plays that are just so-so. The most interesting of those plays is at Theater Horizon now. It's called White, and it has an interesting premise. It's about a man whose work is rejected from an art exhibition because he's a white male, and the exhibition only wants to feature minorities. So he hires a black woman to play him and to pass his paintings off as his.
This is ringing a bell. This is not the first staging, local staging, is it? I seem to remember
this a few years ago. It was done in a reading a few years ago. This is the world premiere, but it was done. And you could have seen it in a staging. It's by James Iams, who is a fabulous artist. He's a great writer. He's a great director. He's a great actor. He acts the best, but that's who does the least. But it's acted to a T by Jessica Bedford, Justin Jane. Jameson Foreman is having a breakthrough year, and luckily I have my note here to find out who I'm forgetting. Jaylene Clark Owens, who's fabulous as the woman he hires, who plays a woman who has, says, there's not enough syllables in my name. You have to be named like Lashonda Wanda or something like that.
So you're saying that this is actually for one of the few times recently that you've seen great acting in a great, or at least they've mixed, a superior play.
Well, that'd be Witness for the Prosecution.
White's
an interesting play and a complex play, and gives you a lot to think about, and is a smart play. But it's also a play that pulls punches. There's a lot that happens I don't believe. There's a lot that happens, seems contrived to make satire instead of leading into satire, including the ending and the concluding thought about the play. So it looks like it's going one place, it goes another place, but that's not sleight of hand that makes you go, wow, wasn't that clever. It's sort of like, whoa, aren't you pulling a punch? So while it's well acted and while it's interesting to watch, it's still a play that I don't think is one I would produce if I had a theater, because I'd say it, for everything it has a quality, I think it's lacking something. And I think what it's lacking is my disbelief is suspended too much.
Okay.
And that's that. And that goes down the road. That goes true for A Doll's House Part 2 on Broadway right now. That goes through with a show called Indecent by Paula Vogel on Broadway right now. And a lot of things that I've seen in Philadelphia, a show that's closed called the Arsonist that was at Azuka through this weekend. Same thing. A lot of great acting and fabulous acting in that show. And then what I saw last night called Buzzed, good acting, but the play was disappointing. Not unwatchable, not boring, just like, okay, why am I here?
Right.
And, I shouldn't be thinking that in the theater. I should be engrossed.
Right.
And I should be watching the way people act. And by the way, breakthrough performance for Alex Kuiper in that. That was Theater Exiled, still there. Breakthrough performance for Alex Kuiper. So that's what's going on. I guess my point is, but the most standard play, a 1950s play, Witness for the Prosecution, given a straightforward production, outshines all the new that have a lot of good performances, but just don't really get to their point well enough, and where I think I'm being lectured to and watching polemics instead of watching drama.
Is it possible that these plays, these contemporary plays, tend to maybe, I don't know, take themselves a little too seriously, or they kind of try to reach too far? I mean, you know what I'm saying? That the entertainment value sometimes seems subsumed by sort of the big picture, big statement aspects of their scripts.
Exactly. Instead of a story, you're seeing a point of view. So instead of somebody like Shaw finding a story that fits the point of view and making it work, or Shakespeare, who does better, even better than that, or even Williams or Miller or Hellman or any of the double L playwrights from the 30s, 40s, from the 40s, 50s, and 60s, the current playwright has an idea and tries to put the idea on stage and not only doesn't expand it greatly from a dramatic point of view, not even from a plot point of view, because they're all 90 minutes. And you get to say, okay, where's the hammer? When's it going to hit me? When is it going to hit me on the head? Instead of, wow, I see. Isn't that an interesting way to present that idea? Boy, I never thought of that before. Instead of so like, oh my God, why don't you just get a soapbox and preach?
There you go.
And that's what's happening.
Okay.
And then, so the answer to the question is yes.
All right. And will I be seeing you at the Saturday Night Fever tomorrow night?
You will not be. I will be making macchiatos tomorrow night at my Google Income job at Starbucks. I will be catching up with Saturday Night Fever. And the more important thing, what a horrible thing to say without seeing either of them, Gypsy, with Mary Martello and Monica Haran, who you know is Amy McDougal from Everybody Likes Raymond, playing one of the strippers, Carolyn Dooner. I knew I'd get her name out sooner or later. Carolyn Dooner playing Louise. I think it's a great cast, and I think I'm looking forward to seeing that.
And that's
that also opens tomorrow night. That's at the Arden.
At the Arden.
So I'm
right.
Looking forward to both of them. I've never seen a good stage production of Saturday Night Fever, but the one thing the Walnut does that other theaters do not do is they do find a way to make the mediocre entertaining, which is the opposite of what we were talking about before. They do seem to find the thing that makes it entertaining, and if it's entertaining, it's enough. I think working from a movie script, they never really got Saturday Night Fever right through the stage. But you'll see tomorrow night, and I'll see sometime this weekend.
And you are aware of the New York Times review when the play opened on Broadway in 99, correct?
Yes.
Which they, absolutely destroyed it. So, and I'm just the only reason I'm even going, I think, is because Saturday Night Fever is such a pop culture touchstone, even for generations unborn back then. That it's probably worth checking out, but believe me, my expectations, I'm not going to say they are low, they are probably subterranean. So
to say something, well, as I said about one play once, it was less substandard than usual. but one thing I could say once about Saturday Night Fever, it's better than Dirty Dancing, which is a horrible piece. And I really dread it coming tomorrow night to television. Why do a remake of something that's good as it is? Why do we have to have NBC doing it again tomorrow night on television?
Don't get
ridiculous.
Me started. Anyway,
I do. Let's get started.
Anyway, that was a very quick 10 minutes. I wish we could do 15 minutes everybody every week. I got to get more time on this thing. Anyway, Neil Zurin, thank you for your insight and your guidance and your wisdom as always. And we will we'll continue this conversation next week.
Okay.
Let's, we're going to move right on to our regular second up each week. And that, of course, is Ken Allen of Mainline Today, and he is also the ultimate. He's the last word in the local hospitality industry in his real position as the monarch of local. I never know what the plural of concierge is, so conciergium, I guess. Or I guess if you were in Tel Aviv, it would be the conciergeim, right?
I haven't been there yet, so I'll let you know when I get there. How you doing, Chuck?
Swinging, baby. As you know, I was in Portland last week, and
we got a lot of catching up.
Yes,
to do.
We do. It was great, and it was my second trip out there. The first time, I mean, it's a cool place. But this time I liked it more. I saw it as a place that, yeah, you know what? Maybe I could live here. Cause last time I was saying, nah, this isn't for me. But I spent a little more time kind of just like riding around looking at things, and I did some great sightseeing, some pretty amazing gardens and, museums, and the like. So, and the food was amazing, but enough about me in Portland. Where are you going this week?
How about if we try another P city, Philadelphia?
Okay.
A little bit different from the Portland, not quite as rainy, although this week it has been. So we're in Center City, and we're going to be going to 18th and Sansom Street. We're going to go to one of my favorite Stephen Starr restaurants. You know, Stephen has, I think he's up to about 30,000 of them right now.
Right. But the week's not over.
Right. The week ain't over yet.
Right.
And, you know, and as a concierge, people are always asking me, you know, what's your favorite restaurant? And they're always expecting, like, grandiose kind of places, you know, finest of fine dining. And, yeah, there's some of those. But in truth, when it comes to Stephen Starr restaurants, one of my favorites of all is the Dandelion. And the Dandelion is
not one that kind of grabs the headlines.
Mm-mm. No, it's not Budokan, and it's not Morimoto or Butcher and Singer, and you know, and that's kind of what I like about it in part. You know, there's a misnomer that, you know, British food equals bad.
Yep.
And it really that's not really true, especially in England today. And let's face it, we've got Gordon Ramsay, you know, all over a TV set screaming and, you know, F-bombing us all over the place. Well, the fact is, there's some pretty good restaurants, and Stephen Starr has taken just kind of the traditional British-style restaurant, and he's plugged it right into Center City. And the thing about that restaurant is, even though it's a theme restaurant, it's British, it's not themey. You know, it's not over the top. It's not, you know, you've got to sit there and look at everything. It's really more about the people that you're with and the food,
right,
that's on the
but
plate
it's the decor is kind of British pubby, or
it's British pub, and it's really authentic. That's what I like about it. You know, it's
so
it's
all the serve all the servers
kill theirs.
All the servers have bad teeth.
Yeah, the big book of British smiles. They, you know, they took a page right out of it for sure. No, and you know, you mentioned about the servers, and another hallmark of my favorite restaurants isn't just a great staff, but it's the family atmosphere that pervades, and how the general managers are considered, you know, just part of the family, and the staff people are equals to them. Nicole Bell is the general manager there. She has been for several years. She runs a really great ship over there, and you know, the staff just doesn't really move around very much like they do at so many other restaurants. You can tell that they hang out together. They're, you know, they're coming into work when they're off of work. That says a lot about a place.
Mm-hmm. And what about the menu, though? Because that's why people go. I mean, it's you know, whatchamacallit, a great staff is, you know, the icing on the cake. But if the cake ain't there, you know, all the best waiters or waitresses in the world are not going to make a bad meal better.
No. And the menu is British fare. What I also like about it is that you can get other things besides your lamb, shepherd's pie.
Fish and chips.
Which they do really good. Fish and chips, obviously. You know, they do short rib over there. You know, but besides hearty foods, which admittedly we're heading into summertime, isn't the best thing, you can get lighter fare, but you can get things like pastas.
Oh, really?
You can, yeah. And
okay,
you know,
so let me ask you this. I'm not trying to be, you know, a wise guy, but why would I go to an English-centric restaurant for pasta? I mean, if I want pasta, there are 6 million places in Philadelphia to get authentic, you know, great Italian-style pasta. So why would I get pasta at a place like Dandelion?
I guess they build it in for the people who are the vegetarians.
Okay.
You know, and
fair
and
enough.
If, you know, try to draw that one person in the group who may not.
Right, because if you can't have something for that person, then nobody's going. I get that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's
but
a good answer.
Let's face
good
it,
answer.
You know, thanks. And the fact of the matter is, it's also a great place to drink. You know, it's one of those places. It's my steady in town. If there is a place for me to stop into, I really enjoy it. They've got a great downstairs bar, but then there's also I suggest making your way up to the upstairs bar. Make sure that it's open first, because they don't always open it. But when they do, it's a lot more intimate up there, and you know, great pictures of Winston Churchill, and they've got the ceramic bulldogs all over the place.
And what about the beer selection? A lot of bitter pints.
Yeah, they have, you know, they definitely have bitters over there. They cater to the craft beer crowd locally. You know, if you don't start offering the local beers as well, people are going to revolt and they won't go there. So they've got a lot of that. But yeah, they do. They specialize in a lot of things, you know, Schmidt's and of course your Guinness Stouts, you know, your extra special bitters that they offer there. What I really like about the place, though, is if you go at happy hour, which I believe is from 5 to 7, Deep discounts. You can get $2 beers.
Oh,
there,
wow.
$3 beers.
Which I mean, absent the, you know, other than the dive bars, usually don't get that in places, you know, like of the Stephen Starr level.
Not of Stephen Starr quality.
No.
Definitely not. And then you can also get with along with Happy Hour, they have like $2 Happy Hour menu specials. Simple things, but shareables. You know, deviled eggs, marinated
right.
olives.
Hmm.
They do a Welsh rare bit. And
what exactly
me,
is
know,
that?
It's toast and cheese.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's just cheddar cheese.
Really? I never, I always, I've seen that. I've never really stopped to kind of do research on what that is. So thank you. There you go. You live in and you learn. And let us.
My parents took they took me down to Williamsburg, and we dined in a very inauthentic British pub back when I was a kid, and I couldn't wait to eat that. That rabbit, you know,
right,
that
that's
Welsh
right,
rabbit.
Right. Yeah, right. That's, yes. Is there anyone who didn't, the first time they saw a reference to that or heard it, didn't think that it was rabbit? Because I know I certainly did. I just figured it was a different way of saying rabbit. Rare, you know, they're not American. Rare bit rabbit, you know. So let us now address for the final 90 seconds or so, or 2 minutes, whatever we have left, the price points. To coin a phrase, at Dandelion,
and
besides the, you know, the specials, besides the happy hour special, the actual menu prices. I mean, what are we looking at for, you know, for a dinner for a person?
So the top menu choices, you know, if you're getting things like a fish and chips or a lamb shepherd's pie, most everything is like around the $15 mark,
which is ridiculously reasonable for Center City
yeah,
and for Stevens,
really, really
one
reasonable.
Of Stevens' places. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's diner prices.
Yeah, there are a few things that are a little
okay.
Bit more
sure,
I think there's a few things in the. In
but
the
it's not going. Here. It's not going to break the budget, and the portions are what size? I mean, you know, 15.
They're ample. You know, they're definitely a good size. You're gonna, if you're not the biggest of eaters, you're gonna be taking stuff home with you.
Okay.
One last thing I want to mention
sure.
about the place. I just don't really drink a lot of hard liquor anymore. Spirits, kind of. You know, I do it for my job when I have to. As
sure,
I'll
of course.
Swear to. But one of the libations I enjoy is a good gin. I really like gin, and that's why I'd probably drink it maybe twice a year. And that's the place I go to because they have probably the best, if not one of the best, gin selections within
really?
The city.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well, okay. I think it's a good place to wrap it up. We've been discussing with Ken Allen, Stephen Starr's Dandelion. Is it at the corner of 18th and Sansom, or it's on Sansom Street, or?
At the corner.
At the corner of 18th and Sansom Street in Center City. And I know there's plenty of I mean, you got to pay for it, but there's plenty of parking. But, you know, that far west, especially a little later in the evening, yeah, parking is not the impossibility it is, say, around, you know, Midtown Village. You know, street parking that I'm talking about, you know, getting a place at a meter for $4 or $5. So I think that
and
would
now
be
that Center City Sips is coming back in town on Wednesday night, she can park in town for free after, I think it's 5 o'clock.
Oh, really? When does that start, or has it started?
I think it starts the week after Memorial Day.
Ah, too bad, because I'm parking in town tomorrow night. Oh, well, that's showbiz. Ken Allen, Mainline Today, and a good egg. Thanks a lot, and we will talk to you next week.
Welcome back.
Thanks, man. See ya. And we'll be back with Ian McDonald right after this.
Help us out now. The sound you've always known. Yeah. The music that's endured the test of time. Live, Creedence Clearwater Revival legends Stu Cook and Doug Cosmo Clifford. Together, they're Creedence Clearwater Revisited. Friday, June 30th, 9 p.m., the Event Center at Sugar House Casino. Tickets are on sale now at sugarhousecasino.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Creedence Clearwater Revisited.
You know, now it's time for me to tell you about the Kibitz Room at the Holly Ravine Plaza at 100 Springdale Road in Cherry Hill. The Kibitz Room serves the Delaware Valley's best traditional Jewish-style food and everything, from their to-die-for hot corned beef, hot pastrami, and brisket, to their best-in-the-business knishes, kugel, and matzo ball soup is completely homemade and absolutely amazing. That's it. So whether for breakfast, for lunch, for dinner, and any and all of your catering needs, you know what to do. You just go see my good pal, Neil Parrish, and that crazy crew of his at the Kibitz Room at the Holly Ravine Plaza, 100 Springdale Road, Cherry Hill. Call them at 856-428-7878 or find them at greatpastrami.com. People like Mick Jagger, Jimi Hendrix, and Rod Stewart were the leading men of the classic rock era, then today's guest certainly makes the list of its greatest character actors. Ian McDonald may not be a household name, but for a half century he has been a musician's musician who has contributed to some of the biggest and most important moments in rock history. In 1969, the multi-instrumentalist and composer co-founded progressive rock giant King Crimson, whose debut LP, In the Court of the Crimson King, is universally recognized as a template of the genre. 7 years later, he co-founded Foreigner, one of the 1970s most potent hit-making machines. His resume also includes guest stints with many artists, including glam rockers T-Rex, for whom he played baritone sax on the band's iconic single, Bang-A-Gong. But Ian McDonald is not just another golden oldie sitting in his rocking chair reminiscing about the good old days. Last week, McDonald's band Honey West released an album called Bad Old World. The group includes his son Max on bass, and yes, the name is a tribute to the 1960s proto-feminist TV series about a female secret agent. McDonald plays guitar and sax on the CD, which he also produced, and he had a major role in arranging the music. In addition, he co-wrote the songs with lead singer Ted Zerkowski, who is a well-known Shakespearean actor and teacher in New York City. Ian McDonald, it is a great pleasure to welcome you to that showbiz. Thanks for coming on.
Well, thank you. Great pleasure to be here. That's quite an introduction.
Well, and quite deserved, I might say. So let's start with Honey West and if you don't mind, tell the story of how you came to collaborate with a Shakespearean actor.
Ted and I lived literally right across the street from each other here in New York, and for a number of years before we even spoke or got together. And I find it's one of those situations where you sort of recognize someone, but you don't actually go up and speak to them because I just don't do that kind of thing here anyway. but we eventually started talking, and I found out that not only was he an acting teacher, but he had a band as well, called Honey West. It was already formed. It was more or less a three-piece band and going sort of old country, all original compositions of Ted's. So I went to see them one night, and I enjoyed it very much. And I saw an opportunity for me to get involved in something, and made a little bit of mutual help. I felt that the band could use a little help, and I needed to get involved in something myself. I think thought that would help me in a reciprocal sort of way. So Ted and I started writing together, and so as a result, the music evolved into something other than country. Mm-hmm. We have this rock album of a variety of styles of music that hopefully all hang together and work as an album as a whole.
So what was it, let's just talk maybe a little more specifically about what was it that drew you to Honey West, as opposed to, I can't imagine that there weren't other opportunities out there the past few years for you, you know, to for projects for you to work on. So what was it that really clicked inside you when you heard the band?
Well, I recognized Ted as a good front man, as it were, singing and playing guitar, but also a really good lyric writer. So that was one of the things that drew me in. It's, as you probably know, it's very hard to find really good lyric writers.
Yes.
So that was one of the things. And I was also, you know, the music had a lot of energy and humor and I just, as I said, I thought that I would like to get involved if they would have me.
And were you someone who was always enjoyed being in a band, being part of a collaborative effort? And some people, you know, like it more than others, I think. Asking if you're one of those people, do you enjoy being in a group situation, in a collaborative, rather than working on your own? Some people prefer to kind of not be involved in a group, but it sounds like, you know, that you get some satisfaction out of being part of a group.
Yes, I do. To me, music is a collaborative art form, not exclusively, but for the most part. I've done things solo wise, and that's fine too. But I tend to adapt to whatever situation arises. So this definitely was a collaborative form, especially, you know, writing songs and performing them, I do enjoy that. What I really love to do is to make records. I love being in the studio. That's probably my favorite thing to do in music.
So you like the often tedious aspect of making records.
Well, yeah, but I don't find it tedious. I love working towards the finished record and just keeping that in mind all the time. And I love the process. Whether it's a process of elimination, taking things out, or, you know, adding things. And, you know, I love arranging, and I try to keep things interesting all the time. As I said, I love the editing process.
Interesting, because I've spent some time in studios recording, and to me it's like just it can get so tedious is the word. It just I have found the limited time that I've spent recording songs in a studio, the process of overdubbing and editing and mastering, it just tends to, you know, it takes a certain type of personality to really enjoy it. Some of us find that to be a little tough slog.
I do enjoy it, and you know, sometimes you get visitors coming to the studio expecting to see all kinds of, you know, marvelous things happening, and it's for someone who is not that directly involved in actually making the record, it can be really tedious.
Well, as a musician, I've actually been involved in making it. I found it tedious.
Oh, okay. So why are you listening to the same thing over and over and over again?
When you get six different variations of, you know, in the remastering, which version sounds better? That's, you know, you have to listen to each one, try to find one little thing that's different. Yeah,
well,
that's a little tough.
Yeah, that's the mixing process.
Right.
All
right. Well,
I don't know.
I'm sorry. I'd like to move on. We can talk about it in the studio all day, but I'd like to get a little time traveling, if we don't mind, for a minute or two, and talk about your early musical history. And were you another of those English kids obsessed with American rock and R&B, rather? So many, rock stars of the era were. British, especially British rock stars and musicians,
of your contemporaries, they all have the same story. Graham Nash, Mick Jagger, whoever, they would grow up, you know, they were obsessed with American rock and especially R&B. Were you one of those kids?
R&B, to a degree, what first got my attention one of the first things that got my attention was the Les Paul and Mary Ford records that at some point came on the radio or that were available as 78s in England, and I loved those. I was pretty young, but for some reason I kind of understood what was going on as far as the overdubbing and multi-tracking and all that. I kind of understood the concept, even though I was probably 6 years old.
Oh, wow.
I just kind of got it, and because it was pretty obvious that...
So when did you start playing? When did you start playing? Did you start on piano?
Probably, yeah. And then it was people like Chuck Berry, of course, and Little Richard that sort of got my attention, and of course, it's a great music, and it enlivened post-war London, it was marvelous, and so I knew that's what I wanted to do,
And how did you actually? Now, how did did you get into King Crimson and sort of make your entry into the music scene of the time?
Prior to King Crimson, I'd been in the British Army as a bandsman, so I learned to read and music and play wind instruments and things like that, and studied to. Harmony and orchestration and things like that to a degree, and then I managed to get out when I was about 21 and looked around the London scene and going to see bands like Fairport Convention and others, I eventually Judy Dybel, who was the singer at Fairport, ended up leaving, and we got together and decided we want to form a band. And I'm trying to make this as short as possible. But, we ended up joining a trio called Giles, Jars, and Fripp, and then Judy left, and eventually Peter Giles left, and Greg Blake came in, and I brought my friend Peter Sinfield, a lyricist, into the fold, as it were. And then King Crimson was.
The rest, as they say, is history.
If that's not too long-winded an answer for.
Oh, no, that was fine. And let's jump ahead a few years. And, Foreigner was about as stylistically and conceptually far from King Crimson as pretty much you can get within the parameters of rock music. What inspired your shift of musical gears, as it were?
Well, it wasn't a shift, really. No. I mean, I've always been. I just adapt or use my abilities to enhance, if possible, any given situation that I'm involved with. King Crimson happened, and we made that, we made In the Call of the Crimson King, but I wasn't, and it was, this genre called progressive rock was suddenly coined, that phrase was coined. I ended up moving to New York and met a guitarist, Mick Jones, on a recording session, and he said he would like to form a band, and would I like to be involved? And so I said yes. I'm like, I just apply my abilities to that situation.
And very well, I might add.
But, I'm sorry?
I said very well, I might add, that you applied your...
Well, I'll try. You know.
So you've always had the reputation within the music world as a player's player. But who are the musicians you've always admired, besides obviously the Les Paul and Mary Ford, as we've established, but who of your contemporaries, who do you really look up to musically?
Well, when I say Les Paul and Mary Ford, I mean, that was a very, early.
Sure, I understand that, but obviously worthy of admiration nonetheless.
Right, yeah. I ended up meeting Les Paul actually one time, which was experience just to meet him. But you know, it's the same as everyone. You know, the Beatles, of course. You know, a lot of the music that was happening. I mean, it was a very fertile time. You know, mid to late '60s. There was a lot going on. I mean. You know, people like Hendrix, all of these great, artists were unavoidable, people like Neil Young and basically I listened to the music that I grew up with, as well as other kind of forms of music, jazz and classical and
right.
So I just trying to absorb whatever's going and try to form opinions about what I liked and what I listened to. You know.
Sure. Okay.
I didn't listen to all. So-called prog rock bands,
Oh, really? That's interesting.
I didn't feel that we were in competition with anyone necessarily.
Right. I know
that sounds a bit arrogant, but we just did our thing, and then I ended up leaving for better or worse, and came to the States, as I said,
right.
And just got involved in something else. But,
okay.
I always knew what I wanted to do, which was to be a musician in the rock
right and
world, as it were.
And you've achieved that, and that's inspiring. Not everybody gets to do what they set out to do in life and where their passion is.
Oh yeah, I know.
Anyway, let's finish up. Now that the CD is out, and it's of course, Bad Old World by Honey West. And we're talking to Ian McDonald, the co-composer, producer of the record, and the legendary rock musician. Anyway, will the band be touring at all this year?
Yes, we plan to. We're in the process of deciding how to go about that. It possibly could be, play on, festivals if that's available to us, but yeah, sure.
Great. Well, that's great news, because the album, I really enjoy the album a lot, and it's quite the rocker. It's quite the rocker, and Ted's lyrics they're he's very strong, and it's a great album. I recommend it to rock fans of any age, not just classic rock people, but just people who love great rock and roll. And rock music. And Ian McDonald of Honey West, thank you so much for joining us today on that Showbiz, and continued success and good luck, and hopefully we'll see you in Philly real soon.
There's more to love at Sugar House Casino. New members sign up for Rush Rewards and get $25 in free play or match play. And a $10 dining comp for Gino Steaks, Tacanelli's Pizza, Zaxby's, and more. Present a top-level player's card from a Pennsylvania casino and get $100 free play or match play. Visit SugarHouseCasino.com for details. Sign up for free today. Must be 21 or older. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
All right. I hope you enjoyed my little chat with the very British Ian McDonald, just an amazing musician. And just a quick reminder before we head to A.D. Amorosi, that next week we will be talking about Motown you know, the Motown label, but specifically the Motown Museum in the Motor City, Detroit, Michigan. And that is kind of in honor of the two-week run that opens next Tuesday of Motown the Musical at the Academy of Music. So tune in for that. If you're a Motown fan, you will not want to miss this broadcast. And, of course, you do not want to miss, ever want to miss, my weekly, I can't say face-to-faces, man-to-mans with A.D. Amorosi, known from Philly.com and The Inquirer and The Daily News and Icon Magazine and Philly Weekly and on and on and on. A.D., how you doing, buddy?
Man-to-man. Man-to-man.
Man-to-man.
Man-to-man. How are you, sir?
I'm swinging. Swinging, as always.
Cool. That's very cool.
Yeah.
Swinging is swinging's a good word for what we got coming up this
week.
Yeah.
Please tell. Pray tell.
Well, you know what? I'm going to start with two dance club things, and then I'm going to work our way to a little bit of rock and roll. First off, tomorrow night, one-time South Jersey native who goes by the name of Calm Trues. That's right, Calm Trues. He is a master of the sort of lo-fi, squelchy, synthwave stuff that fans of Stranger Things from Netflix,
right.
You know how everyone, you know, loves that soundtrack? Well, this kid's been doing this sound for well over a decade.
Hmm.
And he's playing Coda, which is a Walnut Street nightclub.
You know, every time, not that I go past there that often that late at night, but
right?
Every time I have driven past there, you know, at nighttime after, say, 10 o'clock or so, the lines are out you know, on
right,
Walnut Street.
Exactly.
Amazing, yeah.
That's
I always wondered about that place.
Well, that is it. That place, you know what's funny? That place actually plays host not only to DJs and electronic acts, but every once in a while they get a cool rapper or band in there. Deadmau5 played there not too long ago. The place is building quite a reputation.
Hmm.
So
who books that? Is that one of the major, you know, music promoters?
They completely book that on their own.
Impressive.
The same thing is true of the new club that just opened along the periphery of Chinatown, known as Noto. And they opened, 3 months ago? And slowly but surely, they have been booking bigger name DJ talent. And on May 28th, they've booked Steve Aoki. Now, if you're saying, and Steve Aoki is a big deal for a lot of reasons. Number one, he's probably one of the few electronic music / DJs, producer, artist types who sells records, especially since his last big single was with Lewis Tomlinson of One Direction. And just for, you know, just for giggles, his father is Rocky Aoki, who built and developed the
Benihana
restaurant business. So go see Steve Aoki, ask him to cut up some cut up some steak real fast.
But in all seriousness, you know, a lot of people who are listening, I'm sure, are not, you know, conversant in that world. And while I don't profess to be an expert, I mean, Steve Aoki is A-plus lister among that genre.
He is
one of the world's biggest DJs, right?
Yes, he is. And like I said, he owns his own label, Dimac, which sells records of like-minded techno, house, pop stuff. He also is very, very highly visual performer. Yeah, this is what I mean. Guys like Steve Aoki and, you know, guys like Calm Trues, these are A-level electronic music acts. For those who are not, you know, readily familiar, if you're going to dip your toe into that water, these are the shows you want to see.
Yeah, got it.
Most certainly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's move to the weekend.
Yep.
May 27th.
The weekend, the calendar, not the act.
Well, yeah. very good. Of course, there is the Hall & Oates Hoagie Nation.
All right, stop right there to quote Meatloaf. What is the connection? I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm trying to make sense of the cope of this whole tour. Of this whole
tour. Right.
The Hall & Oates, the Hall & Oates / Tears for Fears. I mean, by the time Tears for Fears started to have their top hits, you know, their big hits, Hall & Oates were kind of on the downside. So where's the connection there?
Twofold. Number one, because I did a cover on these guys for Icon this month, and you get a chance to pick it up.
I will do.
I spoke to both Hall and Oates, and each man says, you know, that they have a deep and abiding love for Tears for Fears harmonies and Tears for Fears songwriting. I mean, Daryl Hall all but cheered thinking about the idea of how good songwriters these guys are. Now, if you're wondering, well, what does Tears for Fears have to do with Hoagies? What is really true is that the Hall and Oates / Tears for Fears tour had been booked before a Philadelphia date such as this came about. Live Nation came to both Hall and Oates and their manager, Jonathan Wolfson, and said, look, we have an idea that we would, you know, we'd like you to do a festival that, you know, could very well blossom into something regular. And Daryl Hall told me in the story that one of the reasons, I guess, why they called it Hoagie Nation is that he happens to be a Lebanon bologna / lunch meat fan, swears that he eats it almost every other day.
Huh.
And this is how they came up with the idea of Hoagie Nation.
Which makes sense because it is a kind other than Tears for Fears, which of course is a British act. This is a kind of a Philly-centric bill.
Yeah, it's Schoolie D, it's G Love, it's Sun Little. They really do have a nice selection of Philly acts without burning themselves out. I mean, because if they really do want to make this a regular event,
right?
You know, you want to hold some stuff back.
Sure, so next year it could be like the Strand of Oaks and Kurt Viles
and
Jill Scott's of the world. Yeah,
that is exactly their thinking. So on that level, you know, it is a worthwhile event. The other thing that's going on a little further north on May 27th. At the Count Basie Theater in Rentbank, New Jersey, is the only sort of area date for some time to catch the Little Stevie or Little Steven Van Zandt and the Soul Disciples tour, you know, before he goes to Europe. Because the album just came out the other day. It's called Soul Live. And the album is great. I mean, it sounds like, you know, I think we talked a little bit about this before, but the album sounds like a Southside Johnny record, which, of course, you know, Van Zandt produced and wrote a majority, if not all, the songs.
Right.
So he's not going to be back in this area.
I'm sorry, and where's the gig at? I missed that.
He's playing at the Count Basie Theater in Red Bank,
which
New Jersey.
We've probably talked about before, which is like a scale model of the Tower Theater. It is a wonderful place. But if when you're in there, because of the way the balcony kind of extends out over the orchestra seating, it really is like a miniature. It's probably about a third the size, so seating-wise.
Absolutely.
Wonderful.
Absolutely.
And it's not. And Red Bank is really not that much of a schlep.
No, it's really not. I caught when Jon Bon Jovi did three or four cities last year before the release of his new album. And he did it there, and I can't tell you how great it was.
Oh, my God, I'm sure, yeah.
The acoustics, the sight lines, it's really fantastic.
Yeah. That's great. Well, it certainly sounds like there's something for everybody. We have less than a minute, but do you feel, given the events of the past 24 hours in Manchester, do you feel that the Hoagie Nation gig, that security will be even, you know, stronger or you know, stricter than it may have?
I go to, like you, enough shows to feel, you know, a decent security presence everywhere. And my note to everybody is this. It is going to be inconvenient. You're going to feel hassled. But I will feel safer having someone check every pocket if they want to feel behind, you know, they want to lift up my hat, if they want to feel around my bag, they want to, whatever they want to do. This is a tragedy you can't say how big of a tragedy it is.
No, of course not. You're right. And certainly we will feel the aftershocks of that for many years to come. Yeah.
It's going to be worth any inconvenience. In fact, I hope we don't slack from that level of inconvenience at this point.
Yeah. All right, we got to move along. A.D. Amorosi, have a wonderful and rocking Memorial Day weekend. And we will pick this up next week. A.D. Amorosi, check him out. Just Google his name. I'm sure you can find about 65 million pages of hits on A.D. And that's only for the past month. So take care, man. Thanks a lot.
Thanks,
bye. Yeah. And, you know, you think Mother's Day is behind us, so, you know, you have no reason for any more catering. But the fact of the matter is that we are big time in the catering season because we have graduation parties and, of course, Father's Day coming up in just about a month, I guess 4 weeks or so. So, look, you know what I'm getting at. You want great food. You want people to say, wow, this is such good. What a fun party, man. Those cold cuts were great. That fish plate, that lox and bagels plate. Whatever it is that floats your boat, culinarily speaking, for all of your party needs, you know what I'm talking about. Come on. I mean, you listen to this show, you know where I'm going with this. The only place to go is the Kibitz Room at the Holly Ravine Plaza, 100 Springdale Road in Cherry Hill. And you say, well, you know, hey, I live in Bucks County. You know what? I'm sure they'll be happy if they, you know, as long as the order is legitimate and it's big enough. You talk to my buddy Neil Parrish or anybody over at the Kibitz Room, and I'm sure that they will be more than happy to deliver just one or more of their great platters, whether it's that it's cold cuts, it could be hot food, you know, kugels and things like that, and knishes, whatever you choose. They're happy to accommodate you. Chicken dishes and meatloaf, you name it, they got it. And they'll be happy to accommodate all of your needs. So, now that you got that in your head, how do you get in touch with them? Good question. You can call them at 856-428-7878, or you can find them at greatpastrami.com. And we're going to wrap this up very quickly today. Want to thank everybody, certainly Ian McDonald of Honey West, for spending some time with us and telling us all about his new project. And the three regulars, Leanne Lindsay, hopefully will be back with us next week. But we certainly want to thank A.D. Amorosi and Ken Allen and Neil Zorn for helping us out yet again today with their, so we say, insight and wisdom. And, of course, over in Michigan Troll, Brett Kronberger, keeping twisting the dials and pushing the buttons and keeping everything on the rails, because believe me, I can go off the rails really quickly. Just remember, as you go through this farce called life, this comedy called life, always keep in mind, hey, that's showbiz. Ethel, take us home.
There's no business like show business, like no business I know. Everything about it is appealing. Everything the traffic will allow. Nowhere could you get that happy feeling.